The Stein Online Clubland Q&A begins right now.
Hey, welcome along. It is super great to be with you. And this is our Clubland Q&A live around the planet. It is 3 p.m. North American Eastern Time. That is 4 p.m. in the beautiful Canadian Maritimes. I saw some Treeter today, who enjoys our time check for the Canadian Maritimes, even though he has no idea what it is. It's 4:30 in beautiful Newfoundland and Labrador. Everywhere's beautiful today. Beyond the Americas, 8 p.m. in beautiful London, beautiful Dublin, 9 p.m. Paris and Berlin, 10 p.m. in Cairo and Jerusalem, 11 p.m. in Minsk and Moscow. In both of which sinister capitals they're poking and prodding the EU's eastern borders. It's 11:30 in Tehran for all you Newfoundlanders who move to Iran for the half-hour time zone. And beyond that, of course, it is the early hours of Thursday morning. Welcome to our Clubland Q&A. You know how it works. Any one of the 7 billion persons on this planet can just listen to the show and enjoy it, we hope. If you're huddled outside the Polish border fence in far western Belarus and you're listening, we certainly welcome you. If you want to ask a question, you just have to be a member of the Mark Stein Club. If you don't want to ask a question, no need to join the club. Don't even think about it. Put that MasterCard away and just enjoy the show. Tomorrow, Thursday, it's the rerun of Stein's Song of the Week on Serenade Radio in the United Kingdom. Friday, the Mark Stein Show on GB News. And I hope you'll tune into one or other of those, according to taste. I wrote yesterday about this pathetic bridge situation where there's been a bridge that's been on the to-do list in New Hampshire for 8 years. That's something that would once have shamed the Live Free or Die state. That it's the town of Woodstock, New Hampshire, which basically in central northern New Hampshire is heading up toward Franconia Notch and all that fun stuff. And they got a bridge. They've been waiting to redo the bridge for 8 years. 8 pathetic, pitiful years. And then Joe Biden shows up because he signed the bazillion-dollar infrastructure bill. Now, he's supposedly, we're all expected to believe this. And in fact, if you work for Cumulus Radio, like all the Butch Boys do, you have to believe it or they'll fire you. That's what they announced after January the 6th. So we're supposed to believe that this guy, Joe Biden, is the president of the United States. You usually send out your head of state to open finished infrastructure. If you recall, the St. Lawrence Seaway in the 1950s was opened by Her Majesty the Queen and President Eisenhower, as it's a joint project along the border, enabling big ships coming in to go all the way into the Great Lakes. And so that's when you think, oh, yes, maybe we need the Queen and the President for this. When it's just some, rinky-dink little bridge, like, say, the Rainbow Bridge between Niagara Falls, Ontario, and Niagara Falls, New York, you say, oh, yeah, okay, it's a bridge between two countries, but it's still just some little rinky-dink bridge. So for that, we only need Vice President Charles Gates Dawes and His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales. We've now reached, and this is why I'm starting to yell too early. I'm going to try and keep calm. But if I don't understand. Here's the problem. Isn't it utterly, no matter whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, is there anything more pitiful than sending out your head of state, your president, your commander-in-chief, to go and stand in front of a broken down bridge they've been waiting to repair for 8 years? The town is incapable of repairing it in under a decade. The state is not capable of repairing it in under a decade. So they send Joe Biden there to mumble and prompt prompter squint. And what's he doing? Is he announcing a start date? Is he laying the is he dedicating the bridge and laying the first brick or whatever? No. He says that he's saying, oh, yes, I know, you know, having it on the to-do list for 8 years seems a bit of a long time. But under my infrastructure bill, we will reduce the wait time for your new bridge by a year. So we don't yet know how long it's going to be on that wait list going forward. It might be there 9 years, 10 years, 12 years, 37 years. But otherwise, it would have been there, in fact, 12 months longer, were it not for this. This country's dead. Everything around, look at it, look anywhere. But there is the fact that the Democrats even think that this is some kind of heroic, inspirational photo op tells you how dead, you know, the zombie hyperpower walking. Anyway, that's my... That's my take on that. It was even worse than I thought. You don't do this. You don't do this to. I mean, and even making allowances for the fact that he's out of his brain, and he gave. I think he was saying how many jobs it would create. He started with thousands. Then I think he said 17 million. Then it went down, I think, to 13 million. Then I think he was just like riffing here. Then he said two. So it's something that, wait a minute, I've got some howl round feedback here. Hey, is that better? Am I still getting the howl round feedback? You still getting the howl round feedback? Okay.
What should I do? I might sing selections from Brigadoon while the engineers are testing this. Okay, we're back now. Here am I explaining what's wrong with the world where we can't even correct a pitiful bit of feedback. I'm done with it all. It was all easier. Well, I started in this business. We didn't have problems like this. Anyway, I'm sad about that bridge. You know, I don't understand. It's nothing to do with being a Democrat or a Republican. I just don't understand why anybody doesn't see that as pathetic. It's not just that. Why can't a town, when these towns were settled, they made their own bridges? Then you started having state highways, so the state was responsible for certain roads and certain bridges. Now, apparently, the town of Woodstock, New Hampshire, can't build a bridge within a decade without the assistance of the government of the United States. It's dead. Everything's dead. Everything's dead. Anyway... Mark Zabit says, okay, Mark, who's going to show up next November? The squishy non-testicular Republicans, or maybe a new breed of Republican that are not going to be afraid to poke the Dems in the eye? Can we be that lucky this time? I refuse to send any donations to the RNC until they get a backbone. Well, my entire time in the United States, actually my entire adult life, I've been hearing Republicans talk like this. And every time something comes along, as I was saying to Tucker a few months back, it comes from outside the Republican Party. The Tea Party was a movement outside the Republican Party. After, by about 2009, the Obama inauguration, the Republican base was sick of the Republican Party, and it created the Tea Party movement. And the Tea Party movement had a decision to make of whether to try and be something of its own or to operate within the zombie husk of the Republican Party. And the zombie husk of the Republican Party was what it chose to operate within. Then we have Trump a few years later, and Trump, he decides that, again, he's going to, the base is mad as hell. They're sick. They don't want the Jeb Bush. They don't want the John Kasichs. They just don't want them. They don't do anything for them. You know, if you vote for the Democrats, whatever your bag is, whether it's gay marriage or open borders or transgender sports, you get it. You can say, you can point to things and say, ah, yes, that's right, I got it. You can't do that if you vote Republican. It's continuous disappointment, including with the Trump administration, which, again, Trump had a choice. He could have founded his own political party. And instead, he, too, chose to work within the zombie husk of the Republican Party. And, you know, it's all coming out now. They're doing all these little in-depth, I take it they're excerpts from forthcoming books, in which they talk to Paul Ryan, and he can't help boasting about how he totally screwed over the Trump agenda and ensured how the wall wasn't built. It's not about next November. We're way beyond that now. We're way beyond that now. I mean, I'm just embarrassed, and I don't understand. If you're an American born and bred, if you're an American who's been here for centuries, I don't understand why you're not embarrassed about things like the pitiful spectacle. Basically, they're turning what Conrad Black said to me on Friday is the world's most successful nation. They're turning it into a basket case at super quick time. And America, you know, on the one hand, you've got people egging that on. People saying this is what we need to do to redeem ourselves from the evil of slavery. Oh, was it slavery? I mean, I just meant really white people in general. To redeem us from the evil of white people in general, we have to transform ourselves into something other. And isn't it fantastic that we're just galloping along at breakneck speed? And on the other, you have the pom-pom girls of Conservative Inc. talking about the Constitution. Well, obviously, we're in a post-constitutional order. You have political prisoners here. Do you think that's something that the founding fathers provided for? We have show trials like this guy. Everyone's excited about the. Oh, we're waiting for the Kyle Rittenhouse verdict. you know, the poor judge and these jurors have to make the decision because there are explicit threats on Twitter to explicit threat to hang the judge. And that guy has still got his Twitter account, whereas if you say, oh, I don't know, I've just been paying casual attention to this Kyle Rittenhouse trial, and it sounds like he's acting in self-defense. Well, you'll get your Twitter account cancelled, whereas if you threaten to hang the judge like this guy, your Twitter account will still be up there. But beyond all that, because this is an evil justice system, the minute that this trial is over, probably whether he's guilty or innocent, they're going to try him again. They're going to bring federal charges, federal hate crime charges. Oh, wait a minute, hate crime charges, but didn't he just, like, shoot white people? Yes, 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 but those are the white people who like the black people. So they've got honorary identity group cred, so we'll let the relevant statues metastasize a little so that they'll be honorary minorities. It's an evil system, and I'm not interested in pom-pom girls. You know, it's a post-constitutional order, so at the very least the Constitution failed to prevent this, or the worst thing, the Constitution led to this directly. So the pom-pom girls don't interest me. Larry Davis says, hi, Mark. I believe the Chinese have already won and that many are sucking up to them, trying to reserve a place in the new order. I have youngsters and need a long-term strategic plan for survival. I am frustrated as I cannot come up with one. Put another way, how does one best survive authoritarian rule? Theodore Cumlander also writes, hello, Mr. Snine. In your opinion, has the Chinese Communist Party conquered America and Canada? Well, there is... where did I see this? It was in one of the Indian papers. China has now become the wealthiest country on earth. It used to be, oh, what was the name of that other country that was around here someplace? Yeah, it used to be America, but now it is China. that has become the world's wealthiest country. Its global wealth has tripled over the past two decades. This is a new report by McKinsey and Company. Do you know McKinsey and Company? Guess who used to work for McKinsey? That genius transportation secretary, Pete Buttigieg. The China has now has increased its wealth from just $7 trillion in the year 2000 to $120 trillion last year. That's a jump in net worth of $113 trillion in just two decades. Now, 10 countries account for more than 60% of world income. The world's net worth is $514 trillion. So China accounts for about a quarter of the entire planet's wealth. Republicans, principally Republicans, let this happen. They weren't the kind of Republicans who talk about abortion and gun rights and all that stuff that Republican candidates who never say a word between elections are suddenly so keen to talk about. This is what the Republicans do in the period that's not the 6 weeks before the election. They'll pay a little bit of attention to abortion and gun rights then. The rest of the time, they were facilitating China's takeover of the world. China's takeover of the world, which is now almost complete. This, as I said, I read this story in India Today, it's a remarkable story. China was basically the only country to see its GDP increase last year, and I take it largely this year. So the gap is going to widen. America, and this is why this, did the sinister Chinese Communist Party? No, the Chinese Communist Party, as I said in America alone all those years ago, our enemies are opportunists. And they're looking at us and they're watching us do this to ourselves. And that is why Larry Davis is not wrong when he says the Chinese have already won. Now, if you look at it, we're not even talking about this in America. If you were to watch, let's face it, they talk about it a bit on Fox News. They don't actually talk about it a lot on the talk radio because China, Beijing, yeah, sure, I've heard of Beijing. Shanghai, yeah, sure, I've heard of Shanghai. Hong Kong, yeah. Wuhan, yeah, I've heard of that in the last couple of years. But otherwise, you're talking about stuff that just is foreign and people tune out. So it's easier to talk about, trivia. So the China, and that's on the right, on the left. Or on the so-called mainstream, ABC, CBS, NBC, no one's talking like this because people might get mad about it. I said, I've got a good record here. I said over a year and a half ago that Trump should run on the slogan, make America number one again. He should say that China's a totalitarian gangster state that we have allowed to hijack the planet and he's going to reverse it, make America number one again. Instead, he followed Jared's agenda and he's a loser now. He lost because he followed his idiot son-in-law who's part of the whole kind of Davos set. Eric Dale says, this is another related theme. Hello, Mark and fellow club members. A few weeks ago, you called for abolishing the FBI. Not a few weeks ago. I've felt it strongly ever since I followed Operation Crossfire Hurricane. Because in a sense, you know, when whatever that email Peter Strzok sent to his paramour, Lisa Page, saying we need a plan B, we're living in his plan B. Okay, they weren't able to prevent Trump winning the 2016 election, so they subverted his presidency from within and caused the defeat of November 2020. Although, as I said, leaving it to these boobs like Jared, Trump bears part of the blame for his defeat. But they certainly stole part of the election. And so you have the FBI, you have a federal police agency. I'm not even persuaded you actually need that. And if you do, it should be something with far more limited powers. I mean, I hate this thing when, you know, I mean, it's fantastic. Again, it's just the waste of the decline. If you remember the guy in Vegas who shot all those people from the hotel room, the Mandalay Bay hotel room. And every press conference, there's eight different competing police agencies all lined up, along with all the other stupid bureaus and agencies they have. They're all having to give their statement. Oh, here's the municipal policeman. Here's the county policeman. Here's the state guy. Here's the federal guy. And in the end, none of them solve the crime. None of them know anything. It's just down the memory hole. A guy kills, you know, over 100 people. No one knows why. No one knows what it's about. No, even though there's 37 different police agencies standing at the press conference, none of them have the least bit curiosity to go out and figure out what's happened. So I've been down on the FBI a very long time. That's before you see things like NASCAR. Oh, yes, 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 yes. We'll send 37 people to investigate a garage door pull that some idiot thinks is a noose. Now we're going to Michigan to try and fake up a plot against the Democrat governor. There's just no end to it. It's a corrupted agency. And again, the pom-pom girls of Conservative Inc. Oh, we support our law enforcement. I know those men and women. They're salt of the earth. There's a couple of bad apples up there at the very top. But the men and women of the FBI, that's complete rubbish. All these dirty, dingy machinations they're doing, faking up plots to kidnap governors and all the rest of it. What should we do this week? Well, the Trump presidency seems to be coming to an end. You know what would be fun? Let's go and get out on the streets of this thing coming up on January the 6th and see if we can't do a little agent provocateur work on the site. There's no end to it. And if I hear another one of these pom-pom girls, you know, these men and women of the FBI, they're salt of the... No, there've been no resignations. There've been no whistleblowers. They're all going along with it. It's a dirty, stinking, rotten, corrupt agency, and the very least you should demand of the so-called conservative candidates is that they want to abolish this thing and replace it with something with far less power. And on a related note, Frank Gallenstein, or Gallenstein, I apologise if I've got it wrong, Frank, says, thoughts on the shaman. This is the QAnon shaman. Gallenstein. I can go either. I swing both ways on everything these days. The thoughts on the Q&A shaman, the January the 6th dude with the horned headdress and painted face getting over 3 years sentencing. Yeah, he was sentenced just an hour or two ago to 41 months in jail by a Reagan judge, because under our system, we get to it's important to elect the right kind of politicians so they'll appoint rock-ribbed constitutionalist judges like this guy who's just kicked this guy into jail for 41 months. Now, he's been in solitary for almost a year. His mental health has clearly been damaged by what's happened. He's been in jail since January the 11th. He's been in solitary confinement, and this judge wouldn't let him out of solitary confinement. This guy walked through an open door into the people's house. The door was open. There were no police. He walked in. There were police inside. He sat there. He stood there chatting with the police. And they said, hey, great to see you. We don't mind what you do as long as you don't destroy anything. He didn't destroy anything. But he has been sentenced under obstruction of a federal proceeding, which is one of these white-collar laws brought in about 15 years ago, after the Enron thing, you know, when everyone was concerned about white-collar crime and corporate governance. And this thing was brought in then and is now, for the first time, like all crappily written federal law, which again is an embarrassment. And sorry, I don't think the founding fathers intended 1,000-page bills that could metastasize in whatever you want them to be. So the Constitution didn't prevent that, did it? So we have this. So now we have the we have a law that was created for Ken Lay and the gang at Enron that's now being applied to some penniless loser, 34-year-old guy, who is now going to be spending 3.5 years in jail. For what? For walking around because he had the misfortune, unlike all the other people walking around, to have made his attire sufficiently distinctive that he became a symbol of the rebellion against the established order. And this shames America. Again, I've been using the phrase dirty, evil, stinking, rotten, corrupt federal justice system for a long time. Go back to Conrad Black, because I saw it up close and I was astonished. It's a perversion of common law. America should actually be kicked out of the common law world. But again, the right has to get serious about these things. And you know what else I notice? A couple of our commenters have made this. These are people who were Trump guys to the end, and who believed what Trump was telling them, that there was a possibility that on the big day, January the 6th, Mike Pence would, quote unquote, do the right thing and refuse to certify the election, and the glorious Trump term two would begin. And they believed him, and so they turned out on January the 6th. And then they went to the Capitol, and their lives are ruined while Trump is sitting at Mar-a-Lago and doesn't ever say anything about them. This is the thing. He goes on TV and, you know, talks about himself or talks about this, talks about that. The best thing he could talk about is these poor people. They can't afford lawyers. I mean, I take it their lawyers aren't any crappier than the guys he wound up with in these cases. But it's the same thing, you know, the bar associations don't want anybody representing these people. The law is only for part of the population now. Again. It doesn't matter what your constitution says. If you don't have equality before the law, you got nothing. Because you're not in a land of laws then. You're in a land of men. So the constitution, the basic law, as the Chinese like to call it, we might as well all get used to that term, because that's what we're going to be using in a few years' time. The basic law isn't law if it only applies to some of the people and not all of the people. Owlman from CA, which I take it means California, says, "Hi Mark, congrats on the GB show. With our basic foundations, border integrity, free speech, etc., under huge attack here in the US, and with obvious anti-American morons, and I mean real actual morons in the clinical sense of the word, running our government, do you feel that we should be frightened of what is coming in the future? Because I am afraid for real now, not just complaining about crooked politicians. Best regards and enjoy your upcoming new anti-fire snowstorm bridge infrastructure projects in New Hampshire." That was something else Joe Biden said in his confusion, that your house is burning down and you have to get across the bridge. It was like a really complicated round of Clue. It was it was Antifa with the arson during a very bad snowstorm in which the fire department have all gone to the Bahamas for the weekend. I couldn't actually follow it, but it was an interesting example of the terrors that can befall you at any moment now. I don't think they are morons. This is the thing. You know, they aren't doing this stuff by error. There are people who really believe, you know, as clearly they do. And I'll tell you something. I'll just take a little bit of a kind of a more relaxed crack at this. I became familiar when I was a child with a certain because it was the decolonization era in the 60s, 70s and 80s when dozens and dozens of countries were becoming independent, and it followed, they'd send Princess Alexandra out to the ceremony and the Union Jack would be run down the flagpole and some hideous multi-culti swatch would go up in its place. And a lot of those countries, things worked out pretty well because they didn't change a lot. There were a few, though, that went seriously awry, and they basically abolished their constitutions, or Westminster constitutions, and they turned themselves into one-party states. And the difficulty for someone like the Queen or the Duke of Edinburgh is that you were trying to pretend they were a member of the family, even though they were rejecting everything that made you a member of the family. And I remember the way the tortured justifications you would hear for pretending that some thug of the week in Central Africa was actually carrying on. He was still within the bounds of political normalcy within the British Commonwealth, and I saw through it. You know, when I was 11 or 12 or whatever, I recognised that these statements were complete rubbish. Now, oddly enough, it's what I hear. Here, there's still a tremendous need, and this is worse because it's domestic. It's not about some remote American colony on a distant continent that you can write off. It's about the actual republic you're living in. And you're trying to pretend that people who have abandoned all the norms of political conduct, because all constitutions, doesn't matter whether you're talking about a Westminster constitution or the one the pom-pom girls of Conservative Inc. are so hot for, all of them presume the behaviour of gentlemen. So it's natural to assume that, oh gosh, the Democrats are in power now and they're really idiotic and moronic, and they're making these terrible mistakes and everything's going to hell. No, it's not by mistake. It's by design, because people like AOC are actually the equivalent of those crazier African dictators. They hate their entire inheritance as those dictators. They weren't interested in whether a Westminster constitution works. It's from Westminster, so they want to destroy it. Likewise, AOC and co. aren't interested in making the American system work, because these people think, you know, the thing about it now is they both sort of feed on each other. You know, every time you don't slap down a Jussie Smollett for inventing some stupid story of him taking a stroll in a polar vortex to get a meatball sub. Every time you don't smash a guy doing that kind of fakery into the ground, all these things feed on each other. So that no matter how vile the race baiting gets, the Democrats won't disown it. So there's two reasons for that. Either they agree with it, or even if they think it's a load of hooey, it serves their interest. And open borders serves their interest, and LGBT QWERTY stuff serves their interest. So they're not morons. They're not morons, Al. They're actually being... They're morons if you think that the long-term interests of the nation should come first with them. But if you think in terms of their own power, what they're doing makes perfect sense. And And it's not possible. The idea that they're sort of somehow misguided, they're nice people, they're somehow... That's where the reach across the aisle stuff. I take it there are a few people like that still in the Democrat Party, most rather elderly now. But these new people hate the American inheritance. You wouldn't be doing this. You wouldn't be doing all this statue toppling, which is nuts. As I said, I remember very well all the decolonization process. And I remember, as I said to Tucker one night, the people who kept their statues of Queen Victoria, they're kind of in pretty good shape. And the ones who, took them down and put them in a museum, they're not in such good shape. And that's for a colony. When you're actually taking down Jefferson, Thomas Jefferson, chiseling his name off schools, not in a distant colony, but in your own republic, you're pretty much screwed. And it's not because they're stupid. It's because they're replacing the heroic American narrative with an entirely different narrative. Michael Cavino says, congrats on the new show. Really enjoy it, especially the long form interviews at the end of each show. We've had Conrad and we've had Douglas Murray. It's nice to be able to relax and, not just get them in and out within 3 minutes. Does this mean we will see less of you on Tucker? Well, actually, if you go to and check out whichever bit of the website we keep all these things on, you will see that... Oh, well, let me start by saying Tucker is an heroic figure, and it requires enormous strength to withstand the battering you get. You'll notice, for example, they're trying to get him off air every minute of the day, whereas you take Mr. Constitution, Mark Levin, nobody's trying to get him off the air, which says a lot, whatever that expression is, if you're taking flak, you're over the target or whatever. So clearly they don't care about some guy banging on about the Constitution every day, but the things that Tucker talks about, they do care about. And you have to be enormously resilient to withstand that. And Tucker does, and that's greatly to his credit. But as I said, whatever section of the website we keep it on, whatever the last thing I did on Fox was, I can't remember when it was, but it was about Andrew Cuomo's dog. And yeah, I get it. It's like funny, I suppose. Andrew Cuomo making jokes about his dog is funny. But I came away and I realized, there's many good things on Fox, but I'm not one of them. I'm not talking about anything that mattered. I mean, I can't remember what was going on. Oh, it was the fall of Afghanistan. And nobody at Fox wanted me to talk about the fall of Afghanistan, even though we had some very compelling pieces and had like absolutely huge numbers of readers, and they were being picked up all the time when I was writing about the fall of Afghanistan. Nobody wanted me to talk about the fall of it. It was said, Andrew Cuomo's dog, and is Prince Harry going to be one of the pregnant men? And so it's all just rubbish. Yeah, the pregnant man emoji and Andrew Cuomo's dog. And I'm like 112 years old. And you reach a certain stage in life, and it's unbecoming for a guy who's 112 years old to be just like doing cheap vaudeville about pregnant man emojis and Andrew Cuomo's dog. And we had some, so I was unhappy. And, I came away from that Andrew Cuomo's dog thing thinking, we really got to, if I'm not talking about anything interesting, this isn't worth doing. And, and that's where we stand. I didn't burn any bridges. We had some ineffectual conversations about resolving differences with a very nice lady who's like a senior executive vice president. I mean, I know everyone is a vice president in American corporations, American banks. It's like a standard joke. But I think she's actually one of the super senior, super powerful vice presidents. We had some ineffectual back and forth about it. And I just thought, this isn't going anywhere. It's not how I want to spend what remains of my life. And almost as soon as I'd made that decision, There were a few. Andrew Neil had walked out of GB News, and so there was a bit of a shake-up going on there. And the guy who runs that, who's from Sky Australia, we had some chit-chat, and unlike Fox, where everything, you know, is immensely time-consuming, he basically said, well, yeah, why don't we start Friday? So we did. And that's the situation there. As I said, I haven't burned any bridges, and Tucker is still one of the great guys in America. But even at Fox, the conversation needs to move a bit. Robert Stewart says, Mark, your discussion yesterday about Biden's bridge reminded me of two examples, one that could illustrate what can be done and the other what's usually done. One was Boeing's replacement of a 200-foot span over the Duwamish River about 30 years ago. My wife and I enjoyed going to the Oxbow Rec Center, a Boeing employee park that was located on one end of the bridge. On a Friday, the old bridge was closed to traffic, and on the following Monday, the new bridge was open. Yes, indeed, Robert. At the time, Boeing was making the wings for the B-2 bomber in the same area, so this was an important improvement. Alas, after about 20 bombers were built, the bomber was cancelled and the jigs and forms were destroyed, but at least we have a bridge to show for the project. The reverse example was a road in our Shoreside neighborhood south of Seattle. An earthquake undermined the road in 2001, and a 500-foot long segment was closed to traffic. Two or three years later, in an election year, a large sign was erected announcing that the road would be fixed using federal funds, with a modest amount paid by the state and our city. Prominent on the sign were the names of our congressman, our state's governor, and the mayor of our little city. I believe the total was in the vicinity of $5 million. If we held elections every 20 years, the big sign would have just been erected and the cost would be 10 times higher. But as usual, the completion date would have just preceded the balloting. You are very correct on that. We're going to go a little bit longer because we had a few sound problems at the top of the show, and I want to make sure you have your full value out of that. But as I said, we got a little behind with a couple of our other regular segments, so we're going to do one of them right now, and then we'll be back with more of your questions.
Keep up to date with the past on the 100 Years Ago Show with Mark Stein.
An emperor in exile, a miracle in Mexico, and federally funded babies. It's November 1921.
100 years from today.
Your world news update, the messy aftermath of the Great War continues following the failed attempt by the last Habsburg monarch to reclaim his Hungarian throne. The Royal Navy cruiser HMS Cardiff has deposited the former Austro-Hungarian Emperor Karl and his Empress Zita on the Portuguese island of Madeira to begin a life in exile. Notwithstanding the pressure on the Hungarian government from the Americans, the fallen emperor must surely be wondering if any of his subjects still care for him.
I wonder if you still care for me. All day, dear, I pray, dear, that happy you may be. I'm longing to the west. God keep you, love, and bless you. I wonder if you still care for me.
What What do the people of Europe care for these days? Well, in Italy, a lot of people think fascism is the coming thing. The PNF, the Partito Nazionale Fascista, or National Fascist Party, has been inaugurated by its charismatic leader Benito Mussolini at a convention in Rome. It marks the transformation of what was hitherto more of a paramilitary organization into a political operation. In protest against the fascist agenda, Italian labor unions have called for a general strike within the capital city. Following the assassination earlier this month of the Japanese Prime Minister Takashi Hara, Baron Korakuyo has been installed as his successor in Tokyo. Representatives of Albania and the Kingdom of Serbs, Croats and Slovenes have appeared before the Council of the League of Nations in Paris and promised to respect the tentative boundary line between the two nations that the League's Council of Ambassadors have decreed. In the Soviet Union, Gosbank, the new state bank of the Bolshevik regime, has opened in Moscow. Great Britain's Chancellor of the Exchequer, Sir Robert Horne, has informed the House of Commons that next year His Majesty's government will pay £50 million to the United States in interest incurred on US loans during 1921. There is a fragile ceasefire in Ireland and talks are continuing between the government and Republican representatives, albeit with some difficult obstacles. But both sides are concerned that the slightest incident could ignite a powder keg. At Abercorn Barracks in County Down, Tad Barry, the Bolshevist journalist from Cork, was conversing with fellow prisoners about to be released. According to a sentry, Mr. Barry was trying to escape. The sentry, Private Barrett, fired, and Tad Barry is dead. Michael Collins, among others, is reported to be abandoning the peace talks in Britain to return to Cork for the funeral. His dominions, His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales has arrived in Bombay to a rapturous welcome. But in parts of India, the situation is almost as delicate as Ireland. In the ongoing Malabar Rebellion against rule by the British and high-caste Hindus, Gurkha units of the army have repelled an attack by Muslim rebels at Pandikad. Mappila Muslims are supposedly the oldest settled native Muslim community in India. 122 of them were squeezed into a single railway car for transportation to prison. 64 of those prisoners have suffocated to death along with three Hindus. In the United States, following an overwhelming vote in the Senate, President Harding has signed into law the Willis-Campbell Act prohibiting the prescription of beer for medicinal purposes. Doctors will still be permitted to prescribe one half of a pint of whiskey and wine to their patients, but are limited to issuing no more than 100 prescriptions every 90 days.
Everybody loves a baby, that's why I'm in love with you. Pretty baby, and I'd like to be your sister, brother, dad, and mother too. Pretty baby, won't you come and let me rock you in my cradle of love, and we'll cuddle all the time. Oh, I want to love a baby, and it might as well be you. Pretty baby of mine.
Everybody loves a baby, but they can prove expensive, and mother, sister, dad, and brother are not always either willing or able to pay for them. The House of Representatives has voted 279 to 139 to provide federal funding for the care of pregnant women and newborn children. If this becomes law, other than assistance to Civil War veterans and World War widows, this would be the first social welfare payments by the federal government of the United States. Opponents say that it is unconstitutional and intend to take it to the Supreme Court. Taxpayer-funded babies, how about no babies? Margaret Sanger is an advocate of so-called birth control and was speaking to an audience at the town hall in Manhattan about what she calls contraception. That's to say, devices that work against conception. The audience of men and women appeared to be enjoying the lecture until New York City policemen entered the hall and arrested Mrs. Sanger. Just one day after a record-setting theft of $2 million from the Central Post Office in New York City, the Department of the Post Office has suspended three senior officials at the branch and requested the U.S. Marine Corps serve as guards on mail trucks and railroad cars. In Argentina's San Juan province, Governor Jones has been assassinated. At the Basilica of Our Lady of Guadalupe in Mexico City, a fanatical anti-Catholic attempted to destroy the nearly four centuries old image of the Blessed Virgin Mary that had formed on the cloak of Juan Diego. In the year 1531, the bomb was powerful enough to damage the altar upon which the cloak was displayed and many of the items around it. But the cloak itself and the image of the Virgin upon it were not damaged, much to the annoyance of anti-Catholics. The failed attack is now being cited as a new miracle of Our Lady of Guadalupe. Radio Broadcasting has come to Chicago with the new Westinghouse Electric Commonwealth Edison joint venture station KYW. Its programming consists of live broadcasts of the Chicago Opera Company's entire winter season, 6 days a week. Radio Broadcasting has also come to New Zealand. The Dominion's very first wireless broadcast was made by radio enthusiast Robert Jack from the Physics Department building of the University of Otago. The program consisted of a few words from Professor Jack, prefaced by a rendition of the song, Hello, My Dearie.
Hello, my dearie, I'm lonesome for you. I want you near me as honest I do. Come over, I'm all alone. That's why I called you by phone. Loving like this is some people admire. Cuddles and kisses you can't send by wire. I've got the blues. Don't refuse or you'll lose me. So hurry, hurry, or I will worry. I want you so, goodbye.
Radio has come to Chicago and New Zealand, and a public library has come to Mongolia. The National Library has opened in Ulaanbaatar with an initial donation of only 200 books, so you're advised to get there early. On November the 3rd, Bert Acosta set a new air speed record of 176.7 miles per hour. The record didn't even last the month. The same Bert Acosta, flying the same Curtiss CR2, has set a new world speed record of 197.8 miles per hour. Jenny Kidd Trout was the first woman in Canada to be licensed to practice medicine. Dr. Kidd Trout is dead at 80. And that's the way of the world, November 1921.
100 years from today, 100 years from today.
This is Mark Stein on Stein Song of the Week. This week, a hit that marks the biggest change in pop music over this last century. Paul Simon of Simon and Garfunkel, and indeed of Simon and Rossini, will talk to me about it. And Jane Morgan, Nat King Cole, Carmen McRae will illustrate the point in song. Plus The Bachelors, when they're all out of women. Hope you'll join me for Stein's Song of the Week, Sunday afternoon at 5:30 on Serenade Radio. And 5:30 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time is, of course, 12:30 p.m. On the North American East Coast, 9:30 a.m. on the West. So it's a Sunday brunchy kind of show over here, and we hope you will tune in. George Pereira. George Pereira writes, we're going to go back to your questions. George Pereira writes, I've had a lot of time since those first 2 weeks to try and make sense of what's going on in the world. It's been almost impossible to get anything but corrupted information. I believe this is deliberate and malevolent. Even now, St. Anthony, the patron saint of beagle puppies, and St. Bill, who got marriage advice from a convicted paedophile, are beginning to admit the fake vaccines are not very effective, but everybody in the entire world should take them anyway, and besides, the boosters will fix everything. But the mandates worry me. It's as if something is going to happen. I have this feeling that there is a whole lot of somethings not right going on. I'd like to believe I'm not a paranoid person, but I have this uncomfortable feeling that I can't rid myself of. Any comments? Yeah, I have that feeling too, because we've been in COVID land for 2 years. If you were paying attention, we're coming up to the second anniversary of the first reports of something going on in China. And generally, when something's going on in China, it's going to be going on in the rest of the planet pretty soon. And so it's been 2 years, and they've worked out pretty well for China because no one's done anything about them. And as you note, our governments, the 2 weeks to flatten the curve didn't flatten the curve. And no Western nation other than Sweden tried anything different. Fauci has been all over the place, and yet you call him the patron saint of beagle puppets. And as I said, if you watch ABC, CBS, NBC, if you read the New York Times, you're not aware that Anthony Fauci experiments on beagles. But nobody, you know, at certain times he looks vulnerable, certain time and he goes away and he's not on TV for a bit, but nobody can get rid of. And it's true that all the magazines that, he's a rock star, he's a hunk, he's a stud. All these people go a bit quiet for a while, but in the end he pays no price. And what's happened is that there was this story in the Telegraph in Britain today. The excess deaths, not from COVID. We had excess deaths from COVID last March in the United Kingdom. These are excess deaths going on right now from people who were told to stay away from hospitals, stay away from doctors because, oh, COVID. Got no time. We were the National Health Service, but we're now the National COVID Service. And sorry, if you've got cancer, we don't do that anymore. We might be doing it again in after the 2 years to flatten the curve, and we'll let you know. All these people are dying. Excess deaths from everything other than COVID. Unless you're the Swedes who just did nothing and said, hey, whatever's going to happen is going to happen. Everybody else, the decisions they took haven't done anything. And as I said the other day, as the vaccines don't really meet the definition of vaccine. They're like a Viagra pill. They're like the little blue diamonds. You know, they'll perk you up sufficiently to get you through awkward social situations. So, you know, you pop a couple of the vaccines and you'll be allowed to get on a plane. But they don't actually seem to do much more than that. And in the meantime, we have taught people how to live in a permanent, you know, if this had happened, the reason the world had just gone through the Great War when the Spanish flu hit, and that's like pretty bloody awful if you think about it, pretty rotten. If they had done what they did in the Spanish flu, I think, you know, people were mad anyway, and they threw off the Habsburgs and the Hohenzollerns and the Romanovs, and I don't know what they would have done back then because they had more spunk than we do. And to use that Orwell line, great Orwell line, after being disappointed by the anger he'd expected to find in Northern England Street, he said there's no turbulence left in England. There's actually very little turbulence left in the world. And that, those, whatever it was it 100,000 people on the streets of Melbourne? I mean, God bless them. We could use a lot more of that. Dale Owens, who's a Welshman living near Milan. I don't know whether there are many Milanese persons living in Wales. I always do that. It's a bit Welshophobic, Cymrophobic. Sorry about that, Dale. But Dale says the Anglican Church used to be called the Tory Party at Prayer. That's a long time ago. Would it now be more appropriate to call it the migrant racket at prayer, as evidence emerges it helps asylum seekers to game the system by welcoming them into the bosom of the Church of England? The latest Mohammedan to have received his 72 virgins after the attack in Liverpool is a case in point. Or perhaps BLM at prayer after the Bishop of St Asaph in North Wales backed an unsuccessful attempt to have a statue of the racist, quote-unquote, and, quote, imperialist Welsh-American adventurer H.M. Stanley of Dr. Livingston, I presume, fame, removed from a town in his diocese. I think they are the migrant racket at prayer. And that's true in the United States too. The churches, the mainline churches, because it's immensely financially advantageous for them to get a slice of the migrant racket, because you get federal dough to go along with it. So actually admitting people into the country, letting yourself get a piece of the Haitian refugee racket or the MS-13 racket is very lucrative. And these churches are all in steep decline. So anything that has purse strings attached, either in forms of federal grant or direct payments, makes up for the fact that they're not getting any money in the collection tray on Sunday mornings, or not the money they need. You know, at a certain point, you can't sustain a church. You can't sustain a full-service church if you're not getting sufficient income on a Sunday morning. So something like this actually works to their advantage. The other thing you notice, now I would say if a church isn't getting any money, maybe you should try preaching the gospel. But one thing you know, certainly if you talk to almost any vicar you run into from the Church of England, they actually have very little faith these days. And again, I'm not calling out the C of E in particular. The so-called faith-based institutions in America have very little faith. Just whatever it is, an hour and a half from me, there's a so-called Catholic college that has not a whit of Catholicism left in it. And I don't. So the refugee thing, it's like when the Archbishop of Canterbury starts yakking on about climate change. They do this because they have no faith. So they find false gods. In this case, the false gods of climate change and of diversity. Douglas says, if you were forced to write another book, what would be its topic and thesis? If you're forced to write another book, it's never going to turn out well. I've talked about this before. I don't have much of an urge to. I wrote a book about the demographic. I had a best-selling book about demography, which is bloody difficult to do, actually. You ask any serious demographer if they've ever had a best-selling book about demography. It's not even what I do. But I discerned what was happening, and I wrote about it in such a way that I got a best-selling book about demography. And 15 years later, I think that everything I said in that book is true, and I regret that nobody listened to it. And then I wrote a book called After America, which was about the various structural defects in America. That's about 10 years old, that, I think exactly 10 years old now. And again, nobody listened. The point is that the course we're on is a course for the cliff edge. So what you want are people who will divert us from the cliff edge. And I've said before this, this is why I'm not really interested in a lot of where the conversation is on the American right these days. It seems to me, for example, that the sweet spot now, as Trump recognized in 2015 and then didn't largely in the 2020 election, but it is where you accept that, you know, people are not, when you're talking about small government, people just think you're going to take their various federal programs away from them. So it's not a particularly, it's true, it's philosophically accurate that small government is the best kind of government, but it presumes a people more self-reliant than Western populations in general have shown themselves disposed to be over the last 70 years. So this idea that the sweet spot is fiscal conservatism and social liberalism, I've said, I think, is almost exactly inverted. It's cultural conservatism and not fiscal liberalism, but an acceptance that over the course of the last century, people's attitude to what they expect from the government in terms of, you know, healthcare and welfare programs has changed, and rowing that back is going. There's, you know, essentially there's a consensus among both left and right voters, but that doesn't mean that the conservative voters, the right wing vote, where the opportunity for growth for right of centre parties is that people don't want to live in an utterly transformed landscape, and by utterly transformed I mean utterly ruined. So they don't want to live in a world where all the jobs have gone to China, and there's nothing for you to do except the night shift at the quickie crap or the heroin dealing. But at the same time, you've got open borders, so you're competing for your sub-minimum wage job at the quickie crap or the heroin dealing job with all these people coming in incessantly, to the point where now, under Joe Biden, we're going to be taking in as many people per year as are born in America per year. And secondly, even if you don't want to make an economic argument for that, you're going to die in a bloody violent crap hole because diversity is problematic at the even in its mildest forms. by which I mean Quebec and Ireland, just to take two examples I know very well. And it gets far worse than that if you're in, say, or Fiji as well. Fiji, say, that's another one I know slightly. But if you try to make it any more than that, it's just gonna, because there's always winners and there's losers, as we see now. Actually, and that's why the Kyle Rittenhouse trial, for example, is particularly of interest to me, because when the government abandons you and your city's burning and you're like all these places in Kenosha, Kenosha isn't really a city. You know, most people haven't heard of it and they don't think of it in the way they do of Birmingham, Alabama or whatever. So why it should suddenly break down in race riots? Oh, well, that's a bit of a surprise. What's the government going to do about it? Oh, well, they're not doing it. They've decided they're going to sit this one out. Oh, really? Well, the mob's just coming to burn my house down now. The mob's just coming. My business is aflame. Oh, well, tough. You know, give it a few days. It'll pass. Yeah, but I'll be ruined by then. Kyle Rittenhouse stopped that. And actually, America could use more Kyle Rittenhouses. Because the alternative, as I said, is being consumed by the flames of diversity hell. Diversity is where nations go to die. That's probably... I can't see my publisher going for that title. But there is probably a book in that for someone or other. Let's see, we've got a quick. Oh, Peter says, Mark, do you have any thoughts on the Kyle Rittenhouse trial? Well, I've given my thoughts basically during the course of the show. You know, it's American justice is such a dirty, crappy, filthy toilet of a system. That he's going to be, whatever happens, whether he's acquitted or not, if he's acquitted, they're just going to bring some federal prosecution and what have you, because they want to, he's their example. They want to screw him over as comprehensively as possible so that you, Peter, and your friends and your neighbors get the message that you don't, there's not going to be any questioning of the new order permitted. That's why the QAnon shaman guy has been in solitary for a year. That's why they're trying Kyle Rittenhouse, a guy who, you know, and well, you know, this man had pulled a gun on him, was pointing a gun. Well, you don't know whether he was going to fire the gun at your head, do you? I mean, why did he have to overreact by shooting the guy? People are just having a good time out on the streets of Kenosha. They're anti-fascists. They're people who think Black Lives Matter, and they're just waving guns around and attacking people, but all in good spirits. It's the summer of love, as the mayor of Portland said. And why do you have to go and spoil it all by shooting people? I mean, that guy shouldn't even be on trial. But the thing is, when he's acquitted, he's basically, unless he's got somebody he can sue for all this, he's basically broke. He's basically looking at all kinds of other trials. He's basically looking at a system where social media shut down any mention of support for him. This is such an evil society now. I mean, the only good thing to be said about any of this is that it's softening. If the Chinese actually want to run America the way they run Hong Kong, by moving in their people into the head office and firing anyone who disagrees with them and actually running it as a colony, the good thing is, under the present arrangement, they're softening us up for that so rapidly that we may not even notice the difference by the time Chairman Xi's guy is actually... Well, Chairman Xi's guy is in the Oval Office, isn't he? Oh, yeah. Okay. Frank Gallenstein says, P.S. It's pronounced Gallenstein. Anna Pinkova says, "Hey, Mark, congratulations on your new show. We often hear that we need to return to Judeo-Christian values to save our country. While that's not necessarily false, I think it misses the point. Someone ought to have faith because they believe God is true, not because certain religious structures are good for us. And the attitude seems to be indicative of the problem. Our lives are of utmost importance, but they are not more important than our souls. If we were to value living in truth above living in comfort, our societal problems would sort themselves out. But I'd love to hear your thoughts on the matter." Yes, I have a slight disagreement with Douglas Murray about this. And I've mentioned it before. I think I touched upon it in America Alone all those years ago, because a society without a transcendent meaning is has stepped out of the stream of life and is dying. And so the question is, as you say, often presented in utilitarian terms. Oh, we need to keep some of these churches around. We can't convert them all into mosques and gay bathhouses because it's necessary to have these churches around in order to provide continuity and transcendence in our society. It's a utilitarian argument. But in the end, that doesn't work unless you believe. Now, in fairness, in England, for example, the Church of England was, you know, famously a church for people who weren't really God botherers. I mean, there are an awful lot of people who genuinely like the hymns, and they like the Book of Common Prayer, and they like the buildings, and they don't particularly believe in God or not. And that worked. That did sort of kind of work for a while. In the 1950s, it was that kind of society. It was very peaceful. It was very law-abiding. And people did, you know, in part because you learn all the hymns at schools, because they don't have this hang-up about the separation of church and state. So you go to school every morning and you sing "We Plough the Fields and Scatter," and you sing "Guide Me, O Thou Great Redeemer, Pilgrim Through This Barren Land." And all those hymns you sing every morning, from kindergarten to when you leave high school, stay with you all your life. And so if you're... they tug at you. But in the end, as you say, Anne, and I think this is true, you know, Douglas, in his book, The Strange Death of Europe, Douglas says, yes, I know it's awfully... Douglas himself isn't a believer. He's not a believer. He knows all the hymns. John Derbyshire's the same kind of guy. John isn't a believer, but he knows more scripture than most believers. In, you know, if you stood John next to the average hardcore evangelical, John Derbyshire would win any Bible quoting session with him. But in the end, I think you're right. I've been thinking about this in relation to some of our Christmas programming. And I don't think the Douglas theory, that if we could just agree to, you know, keep up the buildings, sing the hymns, not just go on Easter and Christmas, but maybe fit in a couple of other days during the year. And I appreciate that, because it's like the Houellebecq novel that came out a couple of years ago, Submission, after the election of a Muslim president of France. And Houellebecq's central character he knows something is up, but he can't. He goes, he tries to reconnect with his lost Catholic faith, and he can't quite do it. And the solution, I don't want to give away the book if you haven't read the book, but the solution is actually the easier option, and that's what I worry about in years to come. A nation needs a faith. I don't just mean this shallow, you know. It has to be a meaningful faith. Thank you for that, Anne, and I'm glad we ended on a big, important, profound question there. I've reached that stage of life where there's almost always someone I know in the obituaries column every morning. Even so, I was saddened to see Britain's longest-lived prime ministerial consort, the Countess of Avon, in there on Monday, even at the grand age of 101. Lady Avon was born Clarissa Churchill in 1920, Clarissa Churchill as in the niece of Winston. And she liked the arts, theatre, ballet, music, painting, but she fell in love with the debonair, de facto deputy to her uncle, the Foreign Secretary Anthony Eden. He was well over 20 years her senior, but she set all her love of theatricals aside and gave up the company of Freddie Ashton and Greta Garbo and Cecil Beaton for that of Khrushchev and Eisenhower and Harold Macmillan, whom she found far less congenial. And she immersed herself in politics, and then saw her husband's political career destroyed by sewers, which certainly listeners to this show should know about and readers of After America should know about, because I've been talking about when China is going to do to America what America did to Britain at sewers. Anyway, I got to know her when I was 22 through a mutual interest in the multi-talent painter, writer, composer, Lord Berners, who made her, very lightly disguised, the heroine of his novel, Far From the Madding War. Quote, her hair, as a poetical undergraduate had once said, was reminiscent of a cornfield at daybreak. Her complexion was of that fairness that invites freckles, but as she never exposed herself to the sun, this was not a serious defect. Her type was more suggestive of the 18th century than of the present day. She looked like a nymph in one of the less licentious pictures of Fragonard. All true. All true, I can testify to that. She had a very particular quality of being rather remote, but very funny. A lot of people attempt that, but she was the best at it. Whatever it was now, a couple of decades, a quarter century back, Hugo Vickers was visiting her in Italy at the time the Monica Lewinsky scandal broke. So she asked him to read the newspaper account to her, paragraph by paragraph. And he did so. You know, the black dress, the cigar, Mr. Clinton's preference for non-completion, as Ken Starr put it. And after each paragraph, all she would say was, I see. I still laugh. I can, in my mind's eye, I can see her saying that. The cigar, and then the cigar, the unlit, the cigar was not lit as the White House is non-smoking. I see. Anyway, here's what she told me was one of her favourite pieces of music by her friend Lord Berners from The Triumph of Neptune, the ballet he wrote in the 1920s, choreographed by Georges Balanchine, and this piece is called Cloudland.
Thank you.
Music by Lord Berners from the Triumph of Neptune, the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic, conducted by Barry Wordsworth, which will always remind me of my 22-year-old self sitting in a London drawing room with an elegant and amusing countess. Rest in peace, Clarissa Raven. That will do it for today's show. Tomorrow, Thursday, Laura's Links right here at Stein Online, and on 7/8 Radio, the Thursday replay of Stein's Song of the Week, corker of a song this week with renditions from Coleman Hawkins to Amy Winehouse. That's at 9 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, 4 p.m. North American Eastern. Friday, it's the Mark Stein Show in Vision on GB News, 7 p.m. GMT. That's 2 p.m. Eastern, but it re-airs at 7 p.m. Eastern, which you might find more convivial. Clubland Q&A returns next Wednesday. Stay safe, stay free.
Mark Stein's Clubland Q&A is a production of Mark Stein Enterprises and Oak Hill Media. All rights reserved.